Welcome to this Humanities On Demand podcast from the Maine Humanities Council. This keynote talk by Ilan Stavins comes from the 19th Annual Winter Weekend held at Bowdoin College on March 11, 2016. Ilan Stavins is an award-winning cultural critic, linguist, translator, and public speaker whose work focuses on language, identity, politics, and history. He is the Lewis Sebring Professor in Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College, where his teaching interests include popular culture in Hispanic America, world Jewish writers, the cultural history of the Spanish language, Jewish-Hispanic relations, cinema, Latin American art, and U.S. Latino culture.
Thank you very much for that beautiful introduction. It is a thrill to be here congregating for 2 days around a book, putting all of our attention to it, and doing something that I think humankind has been doing, maybe around the campfire or in the classroom, looking at books seriously and allowing those books to define us, to inspire us, to shape the way we see the world. There are two books that justify the existence of the Spanish language. One of them is Don Quixote, written in 1605, the first part, and the second part in 1615. And the second one is the one that brings us all together this weekend, 100 Years of Solitude. And I know that this might sound as ambitious and even a bit preposterous, two books that justify the existence of the Spanish language, and not the other way around, that make this civilization flourish and express itself in all its complexities in these two masterpieces. The first one was written just as the Spanish Empire was beginning to collapse. It is the most anti-Spanish of Spanish books, and probably the one that is used more often by Spain as its a tourist attraction. People go to the Iberian Peninsula to follow the route of Don Quixote, and Don Quixote has literally replenished Western civilization thanks to his walking around that Spain that was about to collapse. And the other one was written roughly 350 years ago in one of the colonies in a distant, remote place, at least that is where it was originally conceived, a place that certainly many of those that were originally thinking where literature, Spanish language literature, could come from at any point would never imagine. The relationship between Spain and the Americas has not always been a happy one. And certainly when it comes to literature, the thought that Latin America could produce a work that could supersede many others written in Spain and could be of equal stature with Don Quixote is maybe more a result of fantasy or a wild imagination. 100 Years of Solitude is the classic of Latin America. And I want to say two or three things before I enter deeply through many doors to this book that you've been reading in the last few weeks, maybe in the last month or two. I want to say two or three things about classics and see if I can get you in to think about 100 Years of Solitude in from different perspectives. Mark Twain said once that a classic is a book that everybody knows, but nobody reads. And that certainly is the case with Don Quixote. People will tell you a lot about Don Quixote, but many people have not really opened it. They have seen a Man of La Mancha, and that might be enough, the musical. And it's also fitting when it comes to 100 Years of Solitude, because it is a book that is incredibly popular, many people know about it. Many people know the characters of 100 Years of Solitude, but reading the book from beginning to end, and I think you will agree with me, requires stamina, requires concentration, it requires will and devotion. And it is also a book that applies itself to a different type of definition of what a classic is. A classic is a book that chooses its readers. Most books are chosen by readers. I would say that a classic is a book that figures out how to keep loyal and devoted readers and cater them and nourish them and bring them back. A classic is a book that we reread. We not only read, but we reread. It grows with us as we navigate through life, and it's a book that changes the way we change. We come at it when we are young, and we see something in that book, and then we return to it 20 years later, and we realize that the certain things that we remember are still there, but there are many others that we didn't pay attention to, and they tell us a lot about where we stand in life at that particular moment. And 100 Years of Solitude has been, maybe here's another definition of a classic, has been my friend, my lifelong friend. Ever since I read it for the first time, when I was in Mexico, my country of origin, at the age of 17 or 18, everybody was reading 100 Years of Solitude. You couldn't see yourself as a Latin American literate and literary person if you hadn't stopped at some point on its pages. Such was the fame, such was the reputation of this book. And I remember reading it literally on a rainy afternoon, or at least starting it on a rainy afternoon, and I just couldn't stop reading it and went through the night and into the morning, and I had forgotten to fall asleep. This book, in some ways, and this is how I remember my first reading of it, this book, in many ways, had replaced my dreams, had compensated them by offering me a flora and fauna that was similar to the place where I was growing up, but also very different. And it was allowing me to imagine an alternative universe with endearing, enchanting characters. Characters that stayed with me in one way or another, like Remedios the Beautiful, that at one point just is so beautiful that ascends to the sky, or like the twins that keep on fighting with each other and are confused by everybody else around. Nobody knows who is who, and at some point even they themselves no longer know who is who. And the idea of a mythical town in this coastal, a mythical town in this coastal region of Colombia that looked very similar to many places in Mexico where I was growing up, but also had the distinction of being more so, of being an archetype of what Latin America was all about. Many of us have come to believe that this is the Bible of Latin America, the 100 Years of Solitude. It is the Bible in that it is a book that has made many of us understand what is it that makes us Latin Americans. Macondo and the Buendía family could be any town, any lost, forgotten town in Latin America, and any family that exists for six generations. It is a story told in such a way, even from the very first sentence, that feels as if it wasn't really crafted by one writer, Gabriel García Márquez, but as if it was dictated to him by a higher force, and that he was merely the scribe or the secretary. There are many elements in the book itself that make it also biblical. And I don't know if you noticed it. Throughout, there is, from the very beginning, this idea of the world being so pristine, so primitive, that the water just flew through huge, gigantic eggs. That somebody, in the patriarch of the family, has to abandon his place and go somewhere else because there is a ghost that is pushing him to emigrate. Maybe the image of Abraham. There is also the concept of the big plagues that redefine the nature of the entire town and feel repeatedly as if there is a higher force that is making them suffer, maybe punishing them. But this is a book that makes us think that if there is such a higher force, doesn't necessarily talk directly about God. God as being the narrative voice or the higher entity that is defining this. One of the fascinating aspects in 100 Years of Solitude is the tension between the way the characters feel that they are free and the determinism that exists in the family to live life in particular ways. We know, for instance, that at some point there are so many Aurelianos that they feel they have to live the life of their predecessors, that having the name of an Aureliano is a force that is imposed over you, and that you are no longer going to be an individual. You're going to be a character in a larger panorama of what the family is all about. There are characters that have to deal with impurity, with virginity, with the loss of virginity, very much in the way that you have it in the book of Genesis. There are missions to create a sophisticated town that will be attractive to many others in the region. And that also gives you a sense of the journey through a promised land that can be built and cherished, and to which all sorts of other communities, all sorts of other ethnic and immigrant groups can arrive. And there ultimately, this is the story of one family, of a single family, and the ups and downs of that family. How is it that we have this book? How did it become the Bible of Latin America? In what sense is this book really speaking about an entire continent? Who was García Márquez? How did he come to write this book? García Márquez is again, from any perspective, and that is what's so beautiful about literature, it comes from distant corners, from unexpected places, was the son of a poor family in the coastal region of Colombia, a town called Aracataca. I have visited it a number of times. The one of 13 children. There were so many children in that family that, in fact, there were two Gabriels. It seems as if the mother had forgotten that the names have to be different. It tells a lot about the characters in the story, repeating names. His father and mother, his father worked in the telegraphic business, and for that reason had to go from one town to another, and the mother would often follow him. Gabo is the affectionate way that Gabriel García Márquez's friends would refer to him. And the rest of us readers in Spanish have followed suit. And many of us call him Gabo, Gabito. And so instead of him being the older, following the parents from one place to another, the mother left him with his grandmother, and with a number of aunts, a whole galaxy of aunts, many women that ended up being the ones that defined the imagination of this young, very adventurous child. And he says that it was the stories that his grandmother and his aunts would tell him that were the ones that started to inspire him to see the environment in a clear and concrete way. But clear and concrete for García Márquez is a double edge, as you can see in this book. Something that looks clear and concrete is imaginary, is fictitious, and something that is fictitious can look very concrete. And so he says that when he was very young, aside from the stories from his grandmother, he also used to go to a local library, in that he remembers getting a copy of the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights, and falling in love with the idea of this character, Scheherazade, that had to survive by telling stories, not to be killed by the king, the sultan. And so the idea, the readings that he was doing early on of the Arabian Nights with the logic of, or lack of logic, that his grandmother was infusing in him, and the presence of the other female figures were ones that it started to connect him to a very specific place. And I want to pose to you that maybe the protagonist of this book is many protagonists. Of course, the family is very rich in individuals. But I would describe three different characters, three different protagonists as the ones that really keep the novel together, that help the structure move forward. Maybe four. I would say that at the center of it is a town, Macondo. This is the story of the rise and fall of Macondo. Macondo as a mythical place that eventually becomes a very, very earthly, very terrenal place, and ultimately is doomed by its own excesses. It is also the story of a family, the Buendía family. At the very heart of Macondo is this family that has all sorts of connections with the environment and keeps on living the town. Men live the house, live the family, at least many of them, and then come back. Whereas the women, for the most part, tend to be at the heart of the family and stay in the house. They keep the family together. Úrsula, first and foremost. Fernanda will ultimately follow her, although Fernanda is a very complicated character that one never really figures out if to love or to hate. And that is something I think that even the narrator has difficulty explaining. But then there is also the series of characters within that family. And maybe the backbone, the essence of the book is El Coronel Aureliano Buendía, the Coronel Buendía. He is not the first in the family. He will not be the last. But he is the one that will give the novel its gravitas. And he is, in many ways, a portrait of Gabriel García Márquez's grandfather in the way he connected with the civil war in the country, the way he was larger than life, and the way he both gave the family its center and also made the family fall apart. But even beyond that, I think that there's another central character in the book, and that is the house. The house is really what the novel is about. I had a wonderful student about 6 years ago. I devote an entire semester to 100 Years of Solitude, nothing else but this novel. And the papers that the students do are remarkable. One of the great things about teaching is that you're always with young people and that the young people will always surprise you in different ways. One of the students, an architecture major, did a map of how the house grows from the very first scene to the very last scene. And grows means adding rooms and eventually shrinking it so that the family doesn't have that much space anymore and feels suffocated within its own house. How does the house change? What are the flowers that are added? What role do the different trees play? Who sleeps in each room? How is the house in many ways becoming a microcosm of the growth of the entire town, and eventually also the diminishment of that town. The house is a museum, the house where Gabriel García Márquez was born. And when you go to Aracataca, still a very poor place, you see a house that now has become kind of touristy. People want to see that big tree where his grandfather supposedly would sit under the shadow and just wait for history to continue when he was tired of participating in different movements and different actions that had to do with the country's political spectrum. Where Úrsula would cook, where Remedios La Bella would live. García Márquez said repeatedly that he was not a magical realist. And I want now to introduce this term. Probably you've heard it many times, el realismo mágico o lo real maravilloso, in Spanish, magical realism. We tend to attach that term to Latin America, and say that it is a kind of mix of what is ethereal, what is elusive, what is fantastic and imaginary, and what is also very concrete, what is tangible, what is real. And that the Latin American authors, for a variety of reasons that we can go into if you feel like in the Q&A section, are prone to this style of magical realism. Maybe one of the reasons is that it has been said that in Latin America, reality feels unfinished, and that we are far better dreamers, proof of it is 100 years of solitude, than politicians or scientists. And that because of that, we can imagine all this baroque alternative universe and put words into it. And yet, very many Latin American writers, Borges, that was mentioned before, one of the great figures of Latin American literature, Mario Vargas Llosa, Carlos Fuentes, Julio Cortázar, many of them reacted very negatively during their life to the concept of magical realism. They felt that this was a way for Americans and Europeans to see Latin America as a place that was different, as a place that wasn't quite like the United States or like Europe. And instead, they would say, and this was certainly something García Márquez repeated often, that for him, what he wrote in his book was just as he lived it. There wasn't anything imaginary, anything out of the ordinary. He says that he remembers, when he was little, a rainstorm of butterflies, and that he was just including this in the book. And that at one point, when he was 8 or 9, everybody in his town of Aracataca couldn't sleep for a month, and that people were trying to figure out what to do with this epidemic of insomnia. And that he remembers perfectly a crucial moment about which you will hear more tomorrow, of a massacre next to a train station. In fact, he remembers having been on the shoulders of one of his relatives, and the story in the book is told from the perspective of this little child on the shoulders that is perceiving how the soldiers are killing all the workers next to the train station. And he remembers that very quickly people wanted or were forced to forget, that they could no longer keep the story alive and around because it was politically dangerous and it was better to move it to the side. So in other words, he kept on saying often that these elements that foreigners think that are magical realists, for us Latin Americans, and here I'm speaking the way Gabo would speak, are only something common and daily and average. Now, you can always trust a writer about his work or her work, or you can do the opposite. And certainly García Márquez would know how to manipulate information and tell stories or tell things for people to consider them and maybe for people to oppose them. But I want to invite you to think for a second, that if magical realism is the idea that there's such a beautiful woman that she will ascend to heaven without anybody questioning it, that if magical realism is the fact that somebody who's shot, his blood comes out in one of the greatest passages in literature and will follow the path under the door, around a table, through the street, to his mother, for the mother to be able to come back to the house. If magical realism is something that looks strange but is described in a very normal way, what is it that happens at the very beginning of Kafka's The Metamorphosis, one of the books that Gabriel García Márquez admired the most? Or even in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. But let me say, just for a second, in The Metamorphosis, at the very beginning, there is a character that we are told that after uneasy dreams, he wakes up to discover that he's a large insect, a bug. There's a debate what type of insect it is in the different translations. We're not told exactly what that how that transformation takes place. And we are not told either why that transformation happens. It is not because he sinned, or because he suffered from some biological or anatomic challenge. We are told simply that Gregor Samsa has now become a bog. And this is told, this is, I think, the key element for this magical realist side. It is told in a way that seems normal. Yeah, he woke up and he had become a bog. And Garcia Marquez said that if he was a magical realist, then Kafka should be described as a magical realist, and that he had learned a lot in the way of describing this, taking the horror out, taking away the feeling of fear, and simply describing things the way his imagination saw it. There is the story of how 100 Years of Solitude came to be written is as magical as the book itself. Garcia Marquez, having been born in this town, one of the 13 kids, he went to a law school against his own will. His father convinced him that that was going to be something that he needed to do. And you will hear about this also tomorrow. At one point, being already in university, there was a big political explosion in Colombia, and all the universities were closed, and his semester was interrupted, and so he had to find something to do. And so he went to Cartagena, he went to Barranquilla, two cities not too far from Aracataca, and eventually he slept in whorehouses. He had no money. He slept in rooms with friends and on park benches, and eventually he started writing for a newspaper. He became a journalist, and he said all his life that he was lucky to have started as a journalist. He admired very much Hemingway, and Hemingway had also started as a journalist, and he thought, Garcia Marquez, that it was journalism that really had taught him how to write. And that he went even further. He said that the writing of 100 Years of Solitude is really done in a journalistic way, that he is giving you an account of the rise and fall of this town, of the rise and fall of this family, of the construction and destruction of this house, all in a very matter-of-fact kind of way. This is the way things are done. It's concrete and it's direct. He started writing at the same time short stories. You had one in your package where he tried to recreate some of the ideas that his grandmother would tell him. A big old man with enormous wings that ends up showing up in the town. Or a magician that comes and tries through the magic to convince others in town that they can generate other types of money for themselves. They don't have to depend on the government, and they don't have to depend on the church. And he also was writing very psychological short stories. There's one in particular that I adore. It's called One of These Days, and it's the story of a man, he is the mayor of the town, who has a terrible toothache and goes to the dentist. And it is told from the perspective of the dentist in the dentist office. The mayor needs to have his tooth out. There's no other dentist in town. And he is known for being a corrupt and evil politician. And the dentist is known for being left-leaning. So here, it's a beautiful story. It's like five pages. You can already guess. This is the dentist has the mayor in his office, and he can extract the tooth with anesthesia or without anesthesia. How is he going to solve this dilemma? And will he do something even worse than simply getting the tooth out, or will he resigned himself to living in this town, because after this mayor, there's going to be another mayor that is going to be equally corrupt or equally violent. And so the entire thing happens in a very tense psychological way. I won't tell you what the end of the story is. You'll have to find on your own. He started writing these different short stories. And he started, as he wrote these short stories, he started imagining a town, and the name Macondo came for the first time and shows up in one of those short stories. And he started to imagine also a military figure called El Coronel Aureliano Buendía, and he writes them into those short stories in a novella that he produces called No One Writes to the Coronel. And slowly what we readers in retrospect start realizing is that he is building this place that eventually will become the heart of 100 years of solitude without almost knowing that he's doing it. And as he does it, he is a passionate reader of Faulkner. You read Faulkner, I think, in your previous session. And he loved Yoknapatawpha County. And he thought that the American South was very much wounded by history in the same way that Latin America had been wounded by history. And he wanted to do a Faulknerian novel in Latin America. He wanted to write a big book that would tell the story of a single family, like the Sartoris, maybe, that would explain the paradigm of being Latin American and suffering and being caught by loneliness and by solitude. And instead, he produced a series of articles for a newspaper in Bogota, a place that he had, the capital, to which he had already moved. And this told the story of a shipwreck and of a sailor that had survived that shipwreck. And in telling that story, he, as a reporter, found out that there had been some fishy elements connected with the shipwreck. He included it in the story, and he was forced to leave the country because of the dictatorship. The dictatorship thought that these articles were too dangerous. Gómez Pinilla's regime forced him out, and he ended up first in Eastern Europe, then he went to France, where he met other Latin American writers, and eventually he went to my country, Mexico. By then, he already was married and had two children. And the story goes that the family was very poor. He could hardly make ends meet writing for different newspapers. He was also hoping one day to write for the movies. When driving to Acapulco, this resort town on the Pacific, with his wife, Mercedes, who goes by Meche, and one of the kids, it was a Volkswagen that they had. It was bought secondhand. Garcia Marquez, the story goes, the myth suggests, all of a sudden had the inspiration for the very first sentence. Muchos años después, frente al pelotón de fusilamiento, el coronel Aureliano Buendía habría de recordar aquella tarde remota en que su padre lo llevó a conocer el hielo. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, the Coronel Aureliano Buendía was to remember that afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. The first line struck him like lightning, and he turned around. They had been waiting to go on this vacation to Acapulco. Meche, the boy, were all very excited, and he turned around to Meche and said, Meche, lo siento, nos tenemos que dar la vuelta. I'm very sorry, we have to turn around. And I have this line, and the line has to be paid attention, and I have to go back and write. And Meche, Mercedes said, yes, let's go back. And so they turned around, and the story goes that Garcia Marquez went to his office. It was called La Cueva de la Mafia, the Mafia Cave, or the Cave of the Mafia. That's the way he affectionately described it, on the second floor of the house. And he literally isolated himself for 18 months. He wouldn't come out. Meche started selling items that belonged to the family, a watch that she had received from her mother, some silverware, and some friends gave the money, and Garcia Marquez would wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning and write during the entire day and come back in the evening to the room and talk to Meche about it. And for 18 months, he was typing and typing and typing. And I'm using the word typing and not the word writing because it seems to me that he was typing. Think of the difference. There's a famous saying that Jack Kerouac did not write on the road, that he simply typed it. In other words, as if he wasn't really paying attention to it. But I'm not using it in that sense. It seems to me that he was struck by a higher force, and that force was, I'm using an image that is obviously very much ours, downloading the story for him, and that he was simply being the secretary, the conduit for this. In many ways, it's like the story of the famous poem of Kubla Khan by Coleridge, that he had it in his dream. He woke up, sat down, started to write it, and then the mailman came, interrupted it, and he could not come up with what the rest of the poem was all about. Fortunately, Mercedes, and I think that maybe the book should say Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Mercedes as co-authors, because she protected him. She allowed him to devote himself fully to this, to the degree that he was really isolated from the world. There's another famous story that I adore, that at one point, he would come down and he would tell Meche another part of the story that he had just written. Meche, you don't know what happened today. Ursula went to visit Coronel Aureliano Buendía in the jail. Or you don't know what happened today. I have this character that is sewing and creating her own cloth that is going to be part of her own funeral. And then Meche says that one evening he came down and he was sobbing. And she asked him, "Why are you crying?" She said, "El Coronel Aureliano Buendía died today." As if the character now had almost controlled the author and not the other way around, as if the author was journalistically simply describing what these characters were going through. Now think of this. This is a book divided into 20 chapters, written before word processor. Almost all the chapters have the exact number of words. They are not numbered. They were typed and retyped many times with correctors. And Garcia Marquez seems to have... this watches. Maybe Garcia Marquez, the force is coming. Garcia Marquez seems to have known how each of these chapters was going to be shaped. One of the things that I do with the students is try to understand exactly what the dynamic of each of these chapters is. Where does it start? Where does it end? What type of climax do they have? What is the economy of the chapters? And it's very difficult to do it. It is not a book that is done in a straightforward folk tale-like fashion, narratively. It mixes characters back and forth, and they turn around, and there's always a cyclical element in the way time is presented in the book. The more things move forward, the more you realize that they are back, and the concept of time, rather than being teleological, is always moving as if it was an onion or as if it was a spiral. Time plays a crucial role in the book. How does time progress? This is a book called 100 Years of Solitude. Some of us who have read it more than once have tried to figure out if it's really 100 years that are covered from beginning to end. And the truth is, it's a little over 100 years. But 100 years was the title that he came up with just before he sent it to his editor, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Having had, you will not be surprised by this, having had as his working title throughout La Casa, the house. That's how he conceived the book. This was the story of this particular house, this particular home. So there is an interesting separation between the term house and the term home. And at what point does the house in the book become a home for the characters, and when do they lose that quality of them feeling that this is their place? And the same thing happens with the word solitude. I want to stop there for a second because I think it's important. In Spanish, the book is called Cien Años de Soledad, 100 Years of Solitude. But we have only one word in Spanish for soledad. Whereas in English, there are two, at least two. Solitude and loneliness. And one of the interesting aspects that I, and with my students, are constantly investigating is what is it that the characters have that they feel trapped in the solitude? And what is the distinction between being lonely as a character and being overwhelmed by a condition that is solitude? Could the book have been translated as 100 years of loneliness? How different would have the book been? Dramatically different. I said at one point that a classic is a book that chooses its readers. I have many people that over the years come to me and tell me, I tried to read 100 Years of Solitude and I couldn't go beyond the first chapter, if that. Why does he need to repeat the same names in the different families? Couldn't he have come up with something different? Well, again, I think that a classic is a book that chooses its readers. And it's a book that if you go beyond the first chapter, if you certainly go beyond the second chapter, it traps you. It gets you in. And now you want to know more and more. In the English language edition that you have, American readers have the benefit, and so do the Spanish language readers now, but not when the first edition, of having a genealogical tree that you can always go back, and we're always going back to see, wait, what of the 22 Aurelianos this is? And is he the son or the nephew, or is he his own grandfather? Where did this constellation all fit? In Spanish, when the book was first published in 1967, the book did not have a genealogy. And García Márquez did not want anyone to put a genealogy. He thought that it was important for the readers to be able to come up with their own version of who is who in the family. And he also said that if in his family there were two Gabriels, there were many families in Latin America where the father has a name that it's exactly the same than the name of the son, and it's exactly the name than the name of the grandson. And that is a tradition that happened, in his view, more with men than with women, and that it is a way to deposit by the previous generation to endow the successive generations with a kind of task in life. You have to be part of this family. You have a responsibility to be a leader, to perpetuate the family as is. You will notice that with the many Aurelianos and José Arcadios, there is a constant rivalry, and the book becomes its own key to the mystery box. At one point, the narrator even tells you that all the Aurelianos behave in one particular way, and all the José Arcadios, behave in a different way, of course, until you have the twins that are confusing everybody in doing this and that. When it comes to women, there is no such repetition. With women, it is Úrsula or Remedios or Fernanda or all the different characters, and they are much more individual and individualized, and they don't have the task of perpetuating the family. They have the task of keeping the family rooted and having it move forward, but from the house on, not from the outside. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, having finished the manuscript 18 months later, send it, and my heart breaks here, send it by Mexican post to his editor, a new editor in Buenos Aires that Julio Cortázar, a friend of his, had recommended. And what if that, I mean, the Mexican post, I don't have to tell you anything more about it. The great miracle, the great magical realist aspect of the book is that the book exists and that it reached Argentina, an editor who had never really paid attention to this journalist from Colombia that was living in Mexico, started reading it and literally felt transported, flabbergasted, renewed, hypnotized. And there are stories, you've seen it in some of the readings, of his secretary and his colleagues coming to his office, and there were pages of 100 years all over the floor, and he was crying and he was laughing, and he said he had to publish this book right away, and made a phone call to Garcia Marquez in 1967, and it's going to be 50 years next year. In 1967, the book was published in Buenos Aires, the literary capital of Latin America, the equivalent of New York for the United States. And Garcia Marquez was asked with his wife to come to the launching. And the story goes that when he arrived, this is a continent where where illiteracy still is rampant. Where the act and art of reading is isolated for the haves, certainly not for the have-nots. And yet Buenos Aires has always been a very literary and literate environment. And the story goes that when he arrived in 1967 for the publicity, girls were reciting passages of 100 years to him, and that he went to the opera with Meche one night. This is a totally unknown writer, and he sat somewhere in the back row, and somebody who had seen a photograph of him that was used in one of the reviews said, Gabriel Garcia Marquez está aquí. Gabriel Garcia Marquez is here, and that everybody started applauding and gave him a standing ovation. I can tell you, since 1967, to 2016, the standing ovation continues. This is a book that has sold 25 million copies. He won the Nobel Prize in the beginning in 1982, in large part because of 100 Years of Solitude, and a book that he also came to hate, particularly in his middle career. He had written it when he was 40, and he felt that such was the impact of 100 Years of Solitude that anything else he could or would write would always be compared to it. And he wanted people to forget it because he wanted to be, again, a free writer, a writer that could experiment. And maybe some of you have, and if not, maybe some of you will, read his great other masterpiece, Love in the Time of Cholera, a beautiful book about, inspired in the love affair of his parents. And it's an extraordinary book, but for many of us, it's an extraordinary other book. The one book that is always getting all the attention in Latin America is this one, 100 Years. Almost immediately after 1967, it started to be sold to different rights to different countries. And the translation appeared in English 4 years later, in 1970. This is the translation that you have read. This is a book like Don Quixote that is about writing a book. You see that there are the scrolls that Melquiades, from the very beginning, the gypsy, is plotting, and only at the very end you realize. It's a book about a palimpsest, or it's a book about a scroll that tells you its own story, as if you were invited to read what the gypsy, the outsider, the one from the margins, could tell you about the story of this family. Gregory Rabassa, was a teacher of Portuguese background first at Columbia, and then he moved to Queen's College. And he got this book from Harper and Row at that time. They asked him, Cass Canfield Jr., the editor, if he wanted to translate it. He had already translated other Latin American books. He was in the middle of translating one of them, and he said, yes, I'll do it, but you'll have to wait. He got the invitation in 1968, so it didn't come out until 1970. Two things that I think would be important to you as you think about reading the book in translation. The English language translation is astonishing. It's a masterpiece, and this cannot often be said of translations, and I'm a translator myself. And Garcia Marquez at one point even said, maybe to promote it, to promote the publication in English, that the English version by Greg Rabassa was better than the original. He did sell many copies as a result of his statement, but I think that I don't know if better than the original, but really very, very, very good. As good or almost as good. And this is a book that it's not easy to translate, as you might imagine. Even from the very first sentence that I quoted, in Spanish, it is su padre lo llevó a conocer el hielo. His father took him to know ice. And Greg Rabassa immediately puts, his father took him to discover ice. That subtle change of words that maybe is fitting for a translation, no doubt, already gets you a sense that the translator is also an interpreter. At one point, Greg Rabassa was asked if he had enough Spanish to be able to get this book. And his answer, beautiful as it was, he said, actually, ask me if I have enough English. This is a book that pushed me to think of the English language in dramatic, decisive new ways. What type of Spanish does the book use? You don't get this in English. You don't get this in a translation. But it might be useful to you. Garcia Marquez had already spent a lot of time outside of Colombia. He went, as I told you, to the Soviet Union. He ended up in France. Then he went to Mexico. In the interim, he went a number of times to Spain, where he found his literary agent. And he also lived in Venezuela. And what he creates, and I want to go back as a way of conclusion to my very first idea of the classic. This is a book that encapsulates Spanish in the middle, the second half of the 20th century. This is the Spanish that we had. These are all the words that we had at our disposal. And what Garcia Marquez does is create a book that is not in Colombian Spanish. It's not in Mexican Spanish. It's not in Venezuelan Spanish. He creates a Spanish that is beyond countries or beyond regions. He creates a Spanish that is for everybody, but doesn't feel artificial. It feels as if it is the Spanish language that is writing this book. A language that is extraordinarily complex, and that 350 years after Don Quixote can prove in the Americas that there are all sorts of words that come from the Americas that were not Spanish words that have infused this language anew. And so if you read it in the original Spanish, and I hope that if you fell in love with this book, and maybe you fell in love with the civilization that it describes, maybe at one point, if you don't have Spanish, you will learn Spanish and read it in the original. The original is just beautiful and perfect a book as it can be. But it's not fully perfect. A classic, here's another definition, the one that I like the most. A classic is an imperfect book whose imperfections are lessened by the passage of time. There are many mistakes in Don Quixote. I could spend hours telling you about them. And there are a bunch of mistakes in 100 Years of Solitude. Garcia Marquez talked about them. There are a couple of mysteries that are not resolved, including the killing of, that just precedes the threat of blood. There were in the original edition typos that had to do with the name, with different names that had to be corrected successively. And the idea that there, if you read it closely, sometimes some of the events seem to be happening at the same time, but there had to be more time going on between one and the other. But who cares? The fact is that this is, what we look in literature is not for a mathematical formula. What we look in literature is for a sensibility, for the way to express a particular moment in time, for a way to describe and define human character and human emotion, and maybe a way to make language do what language should do, describe the world. You don't have to go to Arakataka to know Arakataka. You don't have to meet the Garcia Marquez family to meet the Garcia Marquez family. This book is offering you all of that. This book is both incredibly local, incredibly regional. This is not a book about Latin America. It's a book about one small town in the coastal region of Colombia. But this is a book about Latin America. This is a book about how we, our families, behave. This is a book about how we dream. This is a book about the wars that we have fought that have led us nowhere, the politicians that have betrayed us. This is the book about the mothers devoting themselves to the well-being of their children. This is the book about adventure and about return. This is the book about the magic of being alive. This is a book that, after all, is becoming a kind of meeting ground for readers from all over the world. Toni Morrison said that it helped her become a writer. Salman Rushdie couldn't have written The Satanic Verses and Midnight Children without it. Isabel Allende is very much a Gabriel Garcia Marquez type of writer. And The House of the Spirits is very much also a story of a particular family. But let me actually give you a slightly different perspective. We are known for our syrupy, sentimental, melodramatic soap operas. You don't need to know Spanish just to flip the channel and get the Spanish channel. And one of the great pleasures of teaching this book, well, it seems to be written to be taught, because it has 20 chapters and you can assign a class, a chapter. There's a lot out there that is already written, the Spark Notes, but there's a lot out there that they will never really figure out. And it's also very telenovela-like. They are backstabbing each other. They are having kids with the wrong person. They are betraying. There is always this overwrought emotion at the heart of it. And I think that in many ways, Garcia Marquez competes with popular culture in that sense. He offers you the sentimental aspect of life that is very much what keeps people tuned in when they watch a soap opera for 3 months or 3 years or three centuries about this family or that family. And so 100 Years of Solitude is the book that has reinvented Latin America, because many people come to it first and then go to Latin America, because it came at a time in the 50s where Latin American writers were not paid attention to, and it put Latin American literature on the map. And it also proved that Latin Americans can write magnificent novels, and that other people in the rest of the world will read these novels and will be influenced by them. That you can come from poverty, and you can come from a former colony, and you can come from absolute nothingness. That's what Arakataka is when you go visit it. And you'll see that there's one tool that we all have at our disposal, language. And we can destroy it, or we can do great things with it. And 100 years of solitude is proof that great things can be done with it. Now that you read it, it's time to reread it. Thank you.
That was a splendid introduction to our weekend. Thank you so very much. We have time for some questions, and the members of the staff have hand mics so we can all hear your question.
Could you talk a little bit about Garcia Marquez's method of writing other than this book, which was an inspirational book, but how was he as a disciplined as a writer?
Sure. You can gather from my anecdote about this particular one that he was a very disciplined one, but discipline meant getting the book out of you and devoting all the time necessary for that to come. He would say that whenever he would be possessed by a particular idea for a book, that he would have to push everything aside and concentrate on that until he was cleansed from that idea and the book was finished, and then he would send it to the editor and for a year or 2 years just live life normally like the rest of us. He had houses in Barcelona, Mexico City, in Colombia, and in his office it was exactly the same furniture, exactly the same books that he had in the shelves, the same computer that he bought. In all three of them, he needed to fully control his environment. He would put himself in the office, and he would lock the door, and Meche would say that nobody could knock, nobody could interfere with him. He was writing until he would come out. Up until A Chronicle of a Death Foretold, which was published in 1982, just as he got the Nobel Prize, he wrote with a typewriter. He wrote 100 years with a typewriter. He wrote Love in the Time of Cholera with a word processor. And in fact, if you reread both books, you will notice the difference. Huh. The first one, there's a kind of rawness. There is a sense of urgency, in a sense that things are in the right place. There's much more fluidity. There's a lot of playing around in Love in the Time of Cholera. And you get the sense that it's the same author, but an author that has now learned to use different tools. From 1982 to the time of his death in 2014, he wrote everything in computer. Up until 1982, he wrote everything in typewriter. And he talked about the fact that the method of the system that he had of a white office with the exact same things, no matter what city he was in, was crucial. I want to add to this answer the fact that in spite of my feeling is that in spite of the fact that 100 Years of Solitude was written with a typewriter, it feels that the words, every time I read it, I am astonished and get the sense that the words are in the right place. To almost as if you open the book and threw all the words up and let them descend, land back on the page, they would find exactly the same position. You get, even if there are typos here and there, you get the sense that he knows exactly how his style is. A style that uses dialogue very sparingly. Entire long paragraphs go on, and you feel that at one point somebody's about to talk, and then when they finally talk, they say, "Don't do it." And then they continue. There's no long stretches of dialogue in Garcia Marquez. And yet, when you hear Ursula talk, she speaks differently than José Arcadio. Each of them, that's the hardest part in literature, to make characters talk so sparingly in unique ways. And he said that he worked very hard in the dialogues. in that he came from a family that told a lot of stories, but that among those stories, you always felt that there was one sentence around which everything rotated.
Could you talk a little bit more about solitude and his sense of why he picked that? Because he repeats the word throughout the book.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is he talks about it not just as a separate experience, but also a shared one or a shared concept. And it's interesting when you talked about the two versus one meetings, English and Spanish, in the 60s. In the U.S., Soledad was a very infamous prison,
right.
George Jackson's book. So you can have the physical separation or solitude, the emotional, but what...
And when he delivered his Nobel Prize address, he called it the solitude of Latin America, and he talked about Latin America being trapped in its own condition of solitude. But it wasn't, you see, the reason why I wanted to bring forth this difference between loneliness and solitude is that the characters can be with other people all the time, but solitude is something larger, something much more complex, something that haunts them, that becomes a kind of curse. And it's the very end of the book. The very end of the book is the condemnation. The families that are condemned to 100 years of solitude will not have a second chance on this earth. And that stigma of this family, of the sense that it is overpopulated, and yet the characters, and specific characters, mostly the men, will feel as if they don't relate to the rest of the world. It's there's kind of a almost an autistic element in the way they relate to the rest of the world. That is fascinating. I wish I could tell you solitude means for García Márquez this. And even if I did, I wouldn't do it. I think the beauty of this book is trying to figure out how time passes in the book and what exactly solitude means. And I wonder if the appeal of the book is not about showing us each, wherever we are, that the culture that we have is in and of itself a type of solitude. I mean, the presidential election where everybody's screaming and shouting, and it also feels that people are really not communicating with one another, and that we're all in this box of resonances that doesn't say much. You get the feeling, I get the feeling that by describing solitude in Latin America, as a reader, you start thinking about your own solitude in different ways and how your culture is or isn't similar to this one.
Great talk. I think we're all learning a huge amount. In the autobiography, two things struck me as really odd. The first is an explicit sentence by García Márquez that, as far as he's concerned, journalism and novelistic writing are the same.
Yep.
There is no distinction.
Yeah.
And then later, he describes sitting on a bus. He must have been in his late 20s. And I think it was in Cartagena, maybe. And he looks across the aisle, and there's an angel sitting in the bus. There's a bus stop. The angel gets up and walks off into the cemetery and disappears.
Right.
So if that's journalism, how many parts of 100 years that we call magical were things that he personally experienced?
I think you said it beautifully. Yes. He believed that a journalist surveys the imagination, that a novelist surveys the imagination the way a journalist surveys reality, and that ultimately you're at the service of what you have to describe. If you go to Latin America, you will see an angel sitting on a bus. You just have to pay attention.
It's reported anecdotally that García Márquez said that the English translation of 100 Years by Gregory Rabassa was better than the original. What do you think that means, if it's true?
What I think is that we don't like to say it, but translations can be better than the originals. Let me give you an example that is a little bit of a detour. My other lifelong passion, as you gather already, is Don Quixote. And there are 22 translations into English of Don Quixote. I would say that the English language is richer in Don Quixote than the Spanish language. We have the sacred one, the ultimate one. But English has 22. And Cervantes and Don Quixote were contemporaries. Cervantes and Shakespeare were contemporaries. It is the two languages, Spanish and English, have not aged equally. It is easier to read Cervantes in Spanish today than to read Shakespeare in English. You get more. We all not age at the same speed or in the same way, and neither do languages. And so 22 different translations mean that there are 22 different ways of reading Don Quixote. And the most recent one is a modernized version. And so it's very easy to read Don Quixote in that translation, much easier than it is to read it in Spanish, because in Spanish it's, again, you know, 4 centuries old. So in the case of Greg Rabassa, the translation, I mean, I read them next to each other. And it's superb. He really hits it on the nail all the time. And a translator has to make little yet constant decisions all the time. And you can criticize a translator for putting discover instead of encounter eyes. But that's fooling yourself, because discover actually does capture an aspect of it and maybe improves an aspect of it too, of the original. In any event, what is beautiful is that you have both. And so you can read the Spanish and the English if you had the two languages. Ultimately, I would turn the question around a little bit and tell you that I have the impression that 100 Years of Solitude is a book about translation as well. Because this is a story of how the story is told. This is the story of characters that are hoping to write down their own story. And it is an outsider who will eventually writes it down for the family and for the rest of us to know. And that is a translation too. A translation is a way to pass from reality to language. It is not surprising also that Don Quixote is also a book that pretends to be a translation from something else. García Márquez did not have a fluent English. And Greg Rabassa would write to him with questions. And some of them were answered by Gabo, and many of them were not. He really deposited on Greg's Rabassa's talent the possibility of creating this wonderful book. And Greg Rabassa translated many books of Latin America. But this one is just extraordinary. It's really, really very good. It's so good that my fear is that there will not be new translations of 100 years for some time, because it intimidates others. And I am all in favor of more translations, even though this one is wonderful. It's like the one of Moncleff and Proust.
Just if you could speak briefly, then you gave the names of many writers, contemporaries, and few years ago, of Latin American writers, and the thing they all seem to have in common is exile.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about the
exile,
the force of exile in Latin American literature?
Sure. Well, exile I could talk about exile in the book itself. Exile, you know, the fact that José Arcadio Buendía has to leave where he and Ursula originally settled, that there's a sin. The sin of having a pigtail child that pushes them outside, and the idea that Coronel Aureliano and others keep on leaving the town and then coming back, and what they accomplish by, you know, going around the world so many times. The exile plays a role, but maybe not through the word exile, but through the world of departure, or the word of a journeying beyond the confines. In the 1960s, 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Latin America, fortunately not anymore, was defined by dictatorships. from Chile to Argentina to Brazil to Paraguay, dictatorships where what the political regimes that established the norm. And writers in a continent where many people don't have access to knowledge or to learning or to literature have always understood themselves in Latin America as spokespeople of those that don't have any voice, of the voiceless, of the oppressed, of the uneducated. And as a result, they are constantly confronting power, speaking against the status quo. There's a very dramatic difference, I think, between the model of the writer in the United States, an entertainer, an explorer of certain realities, and in Latin America, that is a writer that has a political component willingly or otherwise because of the structure of the society. And so many Latin American writers of the 60s needed to go to exile. Vargas Llosa, García Márquez, Cortázar, Donoso, many of them wrote their great masterpieces in Paris, in Barcelona, in Mexico. It takes departure from home to know what home is all about. It's not surprising to me that this is a book about a house and about a home, and that it is written away from the house and away from the home as a way to recreate it. That's what exile is. Exile is to figure out through nostalgia, maybe through melancholia, but certainly through language, how to recreate the world from which you were thrown out. Latin American writers today no longer are forced to go into exile. Many live away from home in the United States, but at that particular time, it defined the region, and it defined the literature as a result. It's certainly 100 Years of Solitude is a book that if it doesn't have exile as a theme, it's in its DNA.
Sort of a comment, maybe more than a question, but then you could comment on it. Going back to what you said about how he was taking the horror and the fear out of things really resonated with me, because when I read it, I appreciated how he talked about death. And I feel like even though the deaths in the book were filled with drama and emotion, in our culture, it seems like death is always like this huge, intense thing everybody stops for, and it's maybe really messy, or it's maybe really... And the rhythm of the book never stopped, and it just kept going. And I wondered if you could comment on how that relates to Latin American culture. Is that more of how they feel?
Great, great last question. I mentioned, and I wanted this talk to rotate around the idea of the Bible, of this book being the Bible of Latin America, because of how it tells our story, because it is a genealogical tale, and because it contains many elements of the Bible in the book, but in a kind of secularized version. García Márquez, as many of you know by now, was a communist with very little interest in religion, very impatient about it, and yet it had filtered itself, religion, into the book and into his vision of things, and you get it in a number of different places. What you get in the book too, when you pay attention to it, is a deep and a probing reflection on death and the afterlife. When a character is killed, but then comes back to keep José Arcadio not alone anymore. His enemy comes back to sit next to him and talk. The very man that he killed and let the blood come out from his throat. You have ghosts that are not a Halloween type. They are not scary creatures. They communicate. They commune with the living in kind of harmonious ways. And if there is exile in the book, there's also a question of what happens when people die. Where do they go? And Garcia Marquez is not one to give you a universe of redemption and heaven and hell, but it certainly gives you a very honest description of how Latin America sees the connection between the here and now and the thereafter. And that is that they are not in opposition, at least not for at the level of the folk, of the popular segments of society. And that you can, and you can see that, I talked about Halloween, you can put it in contrast with the Day of the Dead in Mexico. And that was a day that was important for Garcia Marquez, where people go to a cemetery and have lunch or dinner with their, in the next to the tombstones of their ancestors, and communicate with them for an entire day. An idea that would sound gothic or frightening, because here the cemetery is a place of fear, but not in this culture. And so you have a number of different moments in the book where, you know, the fact that Remedios La Bella just ascends, it's a gorgeous, almost Botticelli-like image of disappearing into the sky. But there's also this sense that she transcends the world. Her beauty is beyond this. And in some ways, she's still with everybody. If all those that have gone away, the family continues. The family is not only those that are living. It's those that are no longer around that have played such an important role. There are, you know, solitude in cyclical time or spiral time, the role of death, the role of freedom, the desire of various characters to change the modus vivendi that they have, but the determinism that exists around, and the impact of history, how history is felt, and the role that memory has. What do we remember about the past? And how is memory a way of resisting? In what way are the act of writing is a form of remembering? And then the government might push a massacre out of the mind. It was told, it is often told, that if it wasn't for 100 years of solitude, the particular massacre that happens in the train station would not be in Colombian textbooks. That after 100 years of solitude, the government had to recognize that this was something that was that was part of the nation's history. And so it goes back to the question of the gentleman before, what do writers do? Writers try to reinstate what the powers that be want to erase or take out. And that is what a novel is all about. Thank you very much, and enjoy the novel.